Nice to have you back, David, on this
Great podcast. To be with you.
Yeah. Let's get started with the conflict in Ukraine and this offensive on the Kursk region. How do you find the current phase of the conflict between Ukrainians and Russians?
Well, you know, it's interesting with the, you know, the offensive that Ukraine has launched against Russia in the Kursk region. You know, they've been able to hold some territory. It's only about 20 kilometers in that they've been able to penetrate. But Zelensky is claiming, I think, I don't know, something like 500 miles, square miles. So I think it's more of a diversionary attack. And it's really kind of similar to the German Battle of the Bulge, where Hitler foolishly decided to waste a lot of Germany's military potential in an offensive operation that had zero chances of success. And I think that's the case here. You know, Ukraine is currently occupied, I think, about 0.006% of Russia. So it's, you know, it's a very minor offensive. It's not something that's going to make a difference in the outcome of the war. It's if the intention was to bring Russia to the negotiation table, it's done the exact opposite. You know, Russia has said that because of the Ukraine Kursk offensive, peace talks are almost out of the question. I think if they were to pull out and accept some of Russia's peace terms, that could change very quickly. But, you know, there's just no sense of reality. And I think, you know, it's clear that this offensive was kind of Western coordinated. And I think that's, again, that shows that a complete divorce from reality that, you know, Biden and other Western leaders have, that they would be supporting this instead of some kind of, you know, more defensive focus alongside negotiations to end the war in a way that's ensures the security and independence of, you know, at least 80 to 85% of Ukraine.
Yeah. You're back.
I wasn't aware that there were any technical difficulties.
Yeah. And we know right now, it seems that the discussion is the reasons behind this offensive on the Kursk region. There are people that are arguing that maybe it's not Washington behind this attack. Maybe London is behind this attack, the mastermind of this attack. How do you find who's the mastermind of this attack? Who was the mastermind of this attack?
Well, I think that it was probably Zelensky's brainchild, supported by the West, you know, in terms of intelligence and other logistics. But I think Zelensky's he feels pressured to show the West that Ukraine is there's some kind of value added to having Ukraine as an ally in fighting Russia, and the value added is you know to try to limit or damage Russia's military potential to keep them busy and to kind of try to show Russia that you know the West is going to do whatever they want without whether Russia cares or not. And again, it's just a very foolish operation. I think every year, you know, Zelensky's tried to come up with some kind of offensive. The first year was very successful. Of course, the Kharkiv and Kherson offensives were quite successful in, you know, in late 2022 and September to November. And that was the period that, you know, U.S. intelligence was warning that Putin might be on the verge of nuking Ukraine. So, you know, the good news is because this offensive is not very successful and it's not very significant, and that Russia is, you know, it's taking away resources from the main front trying to capture Petrovsk in the Donbass, Western Donetsk. You know, Western Donetsk Oblast, that the chances of nuclear escalation seem low unless NATO continues trying to, you know, hit Russia, you know, with deep strikes of U.S. Long-range missiles.
It seems that they're trying to put pressure on Washington. CNN was reporting on that Zelensky may be somebody in the European Union trying to put pressure on Washington to give the permission to Ukraine to attack deeper into Russia. Do you think they're going to get it at the end of the day?
You know, I would say no, but the thing is, you know, every time that Biden has set his own red line that, oh, we won't cross this red line, we won't provide F-16s or M1 tanks to Ukraine because that would mean World War III, we end up crossing it. You know, we just keep escalating. And it's a very foolish policy to keep escalating in what is essentially an unwinnable war against the greatest nuclear superpower on the earth, on the planet, when there's no achievable aim, there's no articulatable strategy. You know, there's been Republican attempts to try to get by the Biden administration to come up with a strategy. There was a deadline. The Biden administration has essentially flouted the deadline. They're not providing any inputs to House committees that have demanded some kind of strategy, or you know, it's just a joke, and there's no reason for the U.S. to be supporting this. You know, we need U.S. leaders to turn against it and put an end to it. And of course, President Trump has the best chance of doing that because the Biden administration is again divorced from reality and entirely committed to this failed strategy of liberal hegemony.
Yeah, it seems that the nuclear power plant in the Kursk region, it doesn't have a dome on it. And that's why it would be so easy for Ukrainian to attack this nuclear power plant. That would be hugely important that IAEA was warning about this. But we know that without having some sort of permission on the part of NATO, they are not able to do that. That would be hugely change the face of the conflict if they go that way, that direction.
Yeah, and that seems to be there's actually a couple theories. One theory is that they were going after the nuclear power plant, that they were trying to capture that, I think, on day 5 of the operation around the 11th of the month of August. And they failed to do that, of course. They were stopped pretty quickly by Russian forces. In terms of their forward advance. But another possibility that's been raised, and I can't remember who raised it, but it was on Daniel Davis Deep Dive. I think it was, his last name's Ho, Matthew Ho, I think. Anyway, he estimated that the Ukrainians were actually trying to capture Russian nuclear weapons, non-strategic nuclear weapons. There's apparently a storage depot. Not far away from the Ukrainian advance. I mean, perhaps 20 to 50 miles. But then the idea there would be, you know, to get Western assistance to crack the codes on those nuclear weapons and try to use those deter Russian attack or try to force them to end the war. And again, very dangerous. You know, Russia wouldn't, you know, as soon as those were captured, they'd start nuking Ukraine or escalating on a very massive level. You know, the biggest surprise for me is that, Russia has the potential to really occupy all of Ukraine. And Putin's essentially ordered the Russian forces not to do so because this war was never about territory. It was always about, you know, ending, of course, the war in Donbass, the civil war against Russian, ethnic Russian civilians in the Donbass, but mainly to push NATO out of Ukraine because NATO had essentially expanded in all but name into Ukraine, and that posed a deadly threat what Russia perceived to be an existential threat, because of course we have, potentially we could base nuclear capable weapon systems such as B-52s in Ukraine, as little as 300 miles from Moscow. So those are the types of things that I've tried to address in my recent peace proposals to end the war in Ukraine.
Yeah. Could you elaborate on this peace proposal? What would you consider as the main issue in this type of negotiating settlements?
Well, there's a couple main issues. One main issue is the issue of Ukrainian military and political alignment. Early on, Putin said, EU membership was fine for Ukraine, so economically they could be aligned with the West. But in terms of NATO membership, that was an absolute red line that Russia would not permit. There's since been some reports of negotiations that appear to have occurred clandestinely in November of last year between the Russian military and Ukrainian military, in which they expressed some kind of openness for some kind of Ukrainian military alignment, continued military alignment, security alignment with NATO. That would, of course, wouldn't be NATO formally. But that they could maybe have some kind of compromise in that area. As I've mentioned, perhaps major non-NATO ally status would be a possibility. That's something we offer to other countries. It's not a binding alliance. It just kind of, it's more of a feel-good situation, agreement that makes countries feel important. But without the binding mutual defense provisions that we have in Article 5 of the Atlantic Charter. So that's kind of the main issue. And then the other main issue, of course, is that, since Russia annexed the four oblasts of Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Luhansk in September of 2022, Russia said that any peace agreement has to recognize the new realities on the ground, which of course are the annexation of what Russia refers to as their new territories. So those are key issues. Other issues, of course, of extreme importance to Russia are, all NATO troops being pushed out, no Western troops at all, no Western bases, no spy bases, no bio labs. They want to have clear limitations on both the size and the types of weapon systems that Ukraine can possess, including the ranges. Perhaps the most important is the range issue. And what's interesting is, I think it was June 15th, and the New York Times published actual drafts, working drafts of, I think, three different versions or variants of, Russian and Ukrainian draft peace agreements. Because, of course, we know that in early April 2022, peace was almost achieved. It was almost finalized and signed between Russia and Ukraine and was only, sabotaged by, President Joe Biden and then UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. So Biden and Johnson, kind of killed that deal. And I think Zelensky kind of wanted to as well. He was looking for an excuse. And the excuse, of course, was the withdrawal of Russian forces from all three northern Ukrainian oblasts in Kyiv, Chernihiv, and Sumy. And that was really, the West paints that as some kind of, awesome Ukrainian offensive that the Ukrainians forced the Russians out. Nothing could be further from the truth. Ukraine was still reeling. They didn't have the ability to engage in any major counteroffensive operations at that time. And it was really just, the early implementation by Russian President Putin, who was apparently, according to the New York Times, he was salivating for peace. He wasn't just wanting peace. Like he was doing everything possible to make peace with Ukraine and end the war, because the whole point of the operation was not to have Russian troops continue in Ukraine after the conflict, but rather to achieve, the expulsion of NATO, essentially, to transform Ukraine back to a permanently neutral state as it had been prior to the Maidan coup of February 2014.
Yeah. Right now, we have two candidates in the United States, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. We know that Kamala Harris would be the same kind of, it doesn't seem that she would change any sort of policies toward Russia if she wins. Here comes the Trump's position toward this conflict. He wants to put an end to this conflict. And we know that he was talking about in 24 hours, I'm going to do this. But we had a there is a new interview J.D. Vance gave to Bill O'Reilly show, and he was talking about European Union focusing on the war in Ukraine while the United States priority is China. Do you think even before winning in 2024, they're receiving some sort of pressures from the political parties? I don't know, those people behind the scene are putting pressure on them just to keep the policy in Ukraine the way it was?
Well, I think it's very clear that Trump officials, campaign officials, people who are viewed, former Trump administration officials that are viewed as having the ear of the president and within its inner circle, are having discussions with European leaders as to what Trump policy would be on NATO, and it's become quite clear, and I've written extensively about it, and it's basically what J.D. Vance stated. Senator Vance has stated that, we want to Europeanize NATO. We want to make it European led. We want to pull out U.S. ground troops, not just from Eastern Europe, as I proposed, but really from all of Europe, I think would be the objective. Now, whether we could achieve that in terms of, Trump, it really depends on who Trump hires for his close national security advisors in terms of whether that could be achieved. But certainly, J.D. Vance would support that, and there are a lot of other great conservatives that would support it as well that are putting America first. The idea would be to, pull out U.S. military resources. We would still have, of course, our Navy would still be used in support of NATO, limited air power, perhaps, nuclear umbrella would remain over all NATO member states. But in terms of, ground footprint, the Europeans would have to come up with those with the troops to defend their own countries, and I think the EU has a GDP that's in excess of four and a half times that of the Russian Federation. The problem is the Russian Federation is much more focused on military industry. They have a much greater defense industrial base. And they can outproduce Europe in terms of European NATO in terms of tanks and munitions and various other important weapon systems. Obviously, nukes, they can outproduce us, nuclear weapons, by, I don't know, about 40 times in terms of a year, their yearly production, probably much more than that. And so, even though they're a smaller country, smaller entity in terms of population and GDP, they do pose a significant military threat in terms of capabilities. Now, the issue is, of course, threat is measured in terms of intent and capabilities. Before the war in Ukraine, Russia had no intent to threaten the U.S. or NATO. But the more we've been fighting Russia, using Ukraine as a proxy, the more they're openly considering potential joint cyber attacks with China against the U.S. homeland and perhaps U.S. treaty allies as well. If the U.S. were, to go to war to defend Taiwan or Ukraine, for example.
Do you think that if Trump wins, he's going to support a comprehensive security agreement between the European Union and Russia?
Well, I think, that it's really, there's just not really a lot of a good, NATO leaders right now that would be supportive of that. I mean, ideally, we would have, as I've written, we would have had Russia as a NATO member by 1995. Allies don't attack each other. They don't go to war with each other. So if we had accepted Russia and Ukraine at the same time, there never would have been a war between Russia and Ukraine, and Ukraine would be whole and free today. They'd have 100% of their territory, including Crimea. So there's been a lot of short-sightedness. And I guess what I'm saying is I think the chances of that are slim. It would really have to be led by the U.S. The U.S. could if Trump were to negotiate the type of mutual security provisions that I've included in my proposed Ukraine peace agreements, then we would, I think Europe would be forced to follow. The U.S. is really, essentially the military protector of European NATO. And a lot of them are essentially military protectorates or even satellites, if you will, of the U.S. And so we do wield substantial influence over their defense and foreign policy. So I think the U.S. Very possibly could pressure NATO into signing some kind of draft mutual security agreement. Certainly not as comprehensive as what Russia offered in December 2021. But I think something more limited along the lines that I've been proposing.
But how about the other part of discussion? If Trump decides to go after this plan of de-escalating the situation in Ukraine, do you think these important players in the European Union, like Germany and France, how would they perceive this attitude, this new attitude of the United States?
Well, I mean, the statements that we've heard is that, European leaders are alarmed that Trump supports ending the war and restoring peace and stability to Europe. You would think that European leaders would support their own interests and support peace and stability to reduce the threat, eliminate the threat of Russian aggression. But instead, they have this mindset that, this hegemonic mindset that Boris Johnson talked about, that we can't allow Ukraine to make peace with Russia because that would be an end to U.S. hegemony or Western hegemony. I think he views Britain as having some kind of hegemony over Europe as well, based on that statement, as if that's a good thing. It's not a good thing for any country to wield so much control over, entire other regions, whether it's Russia, China, or even the U.S. Any type of influence should be wielded peacefully. It shouldn't be through military occupation or satellite status or protectorate status. Countries should, pursue policies that minimize the threat to their own security. And instead, we see European leaders and NATO leaders trying to maximize the threat to their security from a Russia that's led by a rational leader, albeit an autocratic leader in Vladimir Putin, who really is very sincere and has been very sincere about peace and didn't invade Ukraine, in 2022, outside of Crimea, until after 15 years of aggressive diplomacy to avoid war had failed. The West just simply wouldn't negotiate with Putin, even when he was viewed as very pro-Western when he first took power.
Yeah. We had Jake Sullivan's visit to China, and we had Olaf Scholz's visit, Janet Yellen's visit, Anthony Blinken's visit, right now. And every time they're talking about that, we're trying to convince Chinese not to help Russia. And how successful was this policy in your opinion? And why they're not learning from this again and again, asking something that China is not agreeing on with them?
They just simply don't understand the facts and reality of the situation. Russia and China have been close military allies. They've been formal allies since 2001. So it's been 23 years, but very close allies since 2022 when they proclaimed this no limits partnership at the Olympics in Beijing in February of 2022. It was rather hilarious that, the U.S. kind of revealed all its top secret intel that Russia was going to invade Ukraine and then begged China to try to veto it. In fact, they greenlighted it. China was completely on board. They've supported the war to the hilt, despite claiming that they want peace. This is very beneficial for China. It's very beneficial for China to continue the war because they believe that as long as the war continues, then the chances of the U.S. being able to respond militarily to a Chinese attack on Taiwan will be minimized. China has said, we're not going to follow what the U.S. wants. We're going to do exactly what's in China's national interest, and that is to continue massive support in terms of, providing strategic resources, military industrial assistance, and limited weapon shipments to Russia to help ensure that that they win the war in Ukraine.
Yeah. The other conflict would be the conflict in Taiwan that I think it's so important, it's so dangerous if we get into this conflict and if the situation escalates at the end of the day. That would be hugely, we can say that we would get nuclear if something goes wrong in that confrontation. How in do you see any sort of wisdom, any sort of wisdom in the Biden administration right now when it comes to the conflict in Taiwan, or they're just continuing the same mindset that we've been witnessing so far?
Yeah, it's really just rhetorical. I mean, you know, they're just playing lip service to the One China policy. You know, they're not considering any type of potential compromise arrangement, such as I proposed, with like an EU confederation style arrangement that would establish a new Chinese, you know, union. We'll call it a union, but it's really kind of a confederation where there would be Taiwan would not be independent by any means, but it would have self-rule, it'd have control of its own military, its own political and economic system. And, you know, would really, I think, diffuse the whole this whole Taiwan powder keg, because there is, I mean, the indications and warnings that I've been receiving from former national security officials, agency officials, is very alarming. DIA officials are pointing to a potential Chinese cyber attack against the U.S. That could be like could be massive. And, you know, that's why it's important that we meet China halfway. And, you know, they've articulated what they want to hear from us to avoid war and avoid, you know, ensure peace. And one of those things, of course, probably the biggest thing is to cut off weapons shipments. And as much, you know, as much as I love Taiwan and you know, want to support it militarily, I think it's in the U.S. interest to consider cutting off weapons shipments. And, you know, kind of just reemphasize the fact that, you know, the One China policy, and that we want to resolve, you know, the Taiwan issue peacefully. You know, we oppose any de facto independence for Taiwan, but then we want to ensure Taiwan's rights and self-rule as well.
But in your opinion, this proposal, this type of mindset would prevail in the United States, or right now, with the current face of the policies that we are witnessing right now, Democratic Party or Republican Party, they're not getting to that point that we need to talk to China. We need to negotiate with China. And there is no need. It doesn't see, you don't feel it in the foreign policy of the, this is the problem, in my opinion.
It's a huge problem because, you know, as I've looked to see, you know, whenever I publish something that's insightful or kind of out of the box thinking, I right before I publish it, I'll do a search on the online to find anything similar. And oftentimes I'm, you know, surprised that there's nothing similar. There's maybe one article from a foreign, you know, like in the case of Taiwan, a former Taiwanese vice president came up with the same idea that I came up with, and I wasn't aware of it until right before I published it. But in the case, actually, I think it was after I published, I was interviewed by someone else that informed me about it, and so I added it to my article. But in this case, yeah, it's really like forbidden. You know, we're not allowed to think. There's the sad thing about U.S. foreign policy is, we have, you know, if you don't stay in the box within the constraints of whatever the conventional establishment foreign policy thinking is, then you're ostracized, you're shadow banned. You know, I've for example, my last Ukraine peace plan, I submitted, I think, to eight to 10 different outlets, some conservative, even foreign affairs. I only had one response, and they said, you know, we like your proposal, but it's too controversial. And I took a lot of the controversial stuff out to try to make it as mainstream and acceptable to the West as possible. With the Taiwan issue, I think it's even more controversial because no one's talking about any kind of, you know, effort to meet China halfway. The furthest that I've heard is kind of Taiwan declaring neutrality. But, you know, if Taiwan declares neutrality, it's basically declaring independence, you know, because obviously a region of China can't declare neutrality. So based on my information, I don't think that would be acceptable to China. But I do think, you know, I think that that would be kind of an interim step, some kind of non-alignment, I think, would be something good for Taiwanese leaders to say that, you know, we don't align with U.S. anymore. Because I think one of the main issues is that China is concerned that, you know, we want to make Taiwan like a military ally, back to a treaty ally, you know, put U.S. forces. We already have 300 troops that, you know, the U.S. has placed on back in Taiwan just over the last few to several years. And they're special forces troops, and they're just kind of a nuclear tripwire. But we really don't need to, we shouldn't be having U.S. troops in Taiwan at all. So again, there's kind of symbolic measures such as, you know, withdrawing 300 troops. It doesn't seem like a big deal, but I think it would go a long way to helping assuage China and ensuring they don't feel incentivized to attack the U.S. preemptively.
Yeah, the other factor in the concept of China would be the role of the European Union and how they were successful. The United States foreign policy was successful in convincing them for the conflict in Ukraine to be part of this conflict. Right now, when it comes to China, it doesn't seem that would be the case. That's why I think the United States foreign policy should consider that, because the European economy is not doing great right now. If something happens in terms of the conflict, the confrontation between the United States and China, the European Union would be devastated. Their economy would be devastated. And that would hugely benefit if they're considering European Union as their ally. They have to take care of them.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. See, I mean, that's the whole argument for that the neoconservatives and neoliberals use for defending Taiwan militarily. It's that, you know, we have to defend them militarily because we don't want China to take control of all of Taiwan's advanced, you know, semiconductor industries. But the problem is, if we go to war with China, they're going to cut trade off completely with us. And absolutely, every country that gets trade with China cut off will go into depression. I mean, it's economic collapse, possible financial collapse. We've had this foolish idea, you know, stemming, I think, from beginning the Carter presidency with the most favored nation status for China. That was a huge mistake. Reagan followed up supporting that, and pretty much every president but Trump has supported that. And, you know, we built up China into, you know, an extremely powerful global military force and nuclear power. And we've, you know, the neoconservatives, you know, J.D. Vance loves to point this out, but the neoconservatives have, you know, shipped our military and, you know, high-tech industries to China. And now they expect us, they're calling for us to fight China without the industries and ammunition, munition production that we need to be able to fight, let alone win a war with China. So it's really, you know, fighting China is really unthinkable from my perspective militarily, because we no longer have the capabilities that we had 20 to 30 years ago to prevail in a war with China. There's essentially a little to no chance we could win that kind of war. And, you know, Taiwan doesn't have the strategic importance that they claim it does. Taiwan is an island. I think it's a little larger than Moldova. You know, it's a very small island. It's strategic, not in terms of location so much, but in terms of the advanced semiconductor production. You know, I think Trump, I think Trump would be open to reunification talks, serious reunification talks, certainly if China were to blockade the island. And that's something that I think China is open to, like literally blockading the island, I think is they're saying, okay, this is your last chance. We don't want to invade. We want peaceful reunification. The blockade is meant to create the pressure needed for them to accomplish that objective. But if we respond to the blockade by trying to break it forcefully, then it will escalate to a war that will be devastating for the, again, not just for the U.S., but for the EU as well.
And just to wrap up this session, David, whenever we talk about the U.S. presidents, people are mentioning JFK. But in my opinion, someone who is so important and they're not talking about him that much is Nixon and his policy, how he was successful. He was trying to do his best in terms of to come with Russians and with China. And do you think in the future, are we going to get a president? Do you see the capacity right now that we're going to get a president who understands what's going on, at least, and to deal with it? Because right now, both Republican Party and Democratic Party, Democratic Party would say that let's go after Russia and keep an eye on China. And the Republican Party, no, let's go after China, keep an eye on Russia.
Yeah, so I think you raise a great point. Nixon was perhaps the only president in modern history that demonstrated the ability to think strategically. I think his opening to China was well-meaning. I think it was a huge mistake overall. I mean, certainly we wanted normalization of ties, diplomatic ties with China, recognizing that they are a nuclear superpower. They weren't then, but they were a nuclear power that we needed to have peacefully coexist with. But I think it went too far. But, this kind of thinking, I think, would work much more effectively with Trump. Trump does have, he has demonstrated the ability to think strategically. He has demonstrated, during his 2016 campaign, he was talking about a lot of the same things that I've been talking about for the past 15 years in terms of, actually longer than two decades to try to divide the Sino-Russian alliance. And I've been saying since 2003, the way to do that is to withdraw our troops and military forces from their border territories and seas. And then since 2009, I've been saying we need to have this kind of grand bargain with Russia, where we establish, make them, if not an ally, a strategic partner, so they won't have any incentive to ally against us in war or otherwise with China. And I do think that Trump has, he has people in his orbit, advisors, and that think similarly to me, not the same way, but similarly. And his gut instincts, I think, would propel him in that direction. When he was asked if he would defend Taiwan, essentially he said, well, it's transactional. What are they doing for us? If they pay their fair share of defense, or if they pay us to defend them, then yeah, but they're not doing that right now. So he kind of suggested that we wouldn't. And, that's, I think, much more constructive than what Biden has done in saying, four out of five times that he's been asked, he said, yeah, we'll absolutely go to war with China because that's what we're obligated to do, ignoring the fact that we haven't had a mutual security treaty with Taiwan since 1979. So, Biden, he's got dementia. He lives in the past. Apparently, he lives in the 1970s, thinking that we're committed to defend Taiwan as a treaty ally, which it hasn't been for, 45 years. But Trump doesn't have any of those limitations. So he really is a champion of peace. And he's transforming the Republican Party into the new peace party of the U.S. Used to be the Democrats during the Vietnam era, perhaps even during the 1980s. But now it's the Republicans, and it's all thanks to Donald Trump and J.D. Vance.
And do you think that you remember he was talking about in 2016, he was talking about Syria, withdrawing troops from Syria, not sending weapons to Ukraine, not escalating. But at the end of the administration, the Trump administration were totally against him, just doing everything just against everything and anything he wanted to do. And do you think he has learned a lesson from his first term that he's going to apply it right now if he wins?
Well, I think that's an open question. I think that chances are very strong that he has learned. I think he has learned. But there are a few people in his orbit, Robert O'Brien, who's, who tried to not veto, but tried to delay the withdrawal from Afghanistan. and might have been responsible along with Mark Milley for keeping troops in Syria as well. I don't have that information, so I can't confirm that. But, you know, again, that's you raise an excellent point because, you know, we can have insubordination. We saw a lot of insubordination in the first Trump administration where he was telling everyone he wanted out of NATO. He wanted, you know, all troops withdrawn from Afghanistan, Iraq and Syria. And none of that got done. And it was because he had bad advisors, bad military and political advisors. Mark Milley was very insubordinate. He basically told his people that, you know, screw the president. We're going to keep troops in Syria. You know, I mean, that you can't. And then he tried to overthrow Trump. You know, he actually had he plotted. He told the Chinese that we would warn them before we attacked them. So he wanted to get a bunch of U.S. troops killed. But mainly he tried to overthrow Trump. You know, he basically said, well, if, you know, Trump, you know, refuses to leave or does something we don't like, then maybe we'll have a coup. So you can't have that in the U.S. Unfortunately, we've seen that that's become more common than it used to be. Used to be that was the stuff of movies, you know, like, I don't know, can't remember the name, 7 days in May, Failsafe, some kind of movies like that. There was a movie where a general played by, I think, Burt Lancaster was trying to overthrow the government, the president. There was a standoff, and you know, that's kind of playing out in real life, and it's very scary. You know, it's scary for not just for the U.S., but I think others across the world to see you know, the absolute fall and destruction of democracy and democratic traditions here in the U.S. when we purport to champion it. You know, Biden has. He claims to be fighting the war against autocracy, but he's supporting a dictator in Ukraine, and he's you know, trying to throw his main presidential challenger in prison, you know, persecuting his political opposition, doing all the things that he accuses Putin of doing. Yeah, it's a very dangerous world we're living in right now, but dangerous time.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us today, David. Great pleasure as always.
Thanks so much. It was great to be with you, Neiman.